privatized airports in the UK. Is there any lesson for New York City? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Robert Poole, who is the Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. And Bob has written in the past about privatization, which made him kind of a flashpoint or lightning rod in the aviation debates. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be back.
Wanted to ask you about two things you wrote about recently. People are claiming that privatization at Heathrow Airport, the model that was set up under Margaret Thatcher, has been somewhat of a failure. And you had some kind of interesting comments on that. Tell us, first of all, what Margaret Thatcher set out to do.
Okay. It was part of an overall privatization of a great many government-owned enterprises in the UK, the railroads, the electricity industry, the water industry, the seaports. So airports was, you know, just another one of the whole set of things. And what they did in 1987 was have an initial public offering, an IPO, of all 100% of the shares of BAA, which is the British Airports Authority at the time, which owned not only the three major airports in London, but also four airports at that time in Scotland. And it was a big success. They raised $3 or $4 billion, which seemed like a lot of money at the time. The BAA today is worth about $18 billion after 20 years. But that was what they did. They privatized the whole thing as one company. And then they, because the three London airports have about 95% of all the traffic in and out of London, they said, well, you know, that is kind of a monopoly. So they put in price regulation on the air side and put in basically a regime of price controls.
Well, this is where I think you believe they kind of missed the boat. How could they have done this differently? If you have a private enterprise taking over this function, you need, I would think, in order for it to run right, competition and market forces would be a much better way to do it than having a monopoly that's regulated.
That's exactly right. If you have only one airport in a city, then you're pretty much stuck. It is a monopoly in terms of serving the people in that city, and so therefore you do need some kind of regulation to protect people. But if you have a situation where airports can naturally compete, then you may well not need any regulation at all, or certainly much less onerous regulation. And so it was a situation. Many three different think tanks in the UK recommended that they sell each of those London airports, Heathrow, Gatwick, and Stansted, separately, and allow them to compete fully and try to develop different market niches, different approaches to dealing with passengers, ground access, and so forth. UK government had two reasons for not doing that. One, they thought they'd get more money by selling a monopoly, probably right. And two, they wanted to be able to basically still influence the BAA to shift money from one airport to the other. You know, everybody knew Heathrow would be the biggest cash cow. It was much, much more so then. The other two, Gatwick, I think, was barely making money, and Stansted was not making money at the time. So they wanted to be able to cross-subsidize one airport from the other. And that made, from their standpoint, made sense to keep them all as one.
Well, and to be fair, they still wanted to have their finger in it.
That's right. That's right. They wanted those traffic distribution rules, so-called, so that they could say, well, we want Heathrow to do this, and we want Stansted to do that, et cetera. And so, you know, the government was kind of talking out of both sides of its mouth, you know, saying, oh, we believe in the free market, that's why we're privatizing, but at the same time, they wanted to keep control.
What could they do now to turn it around? I know this reminds me a little bit of the situation that the U.S. was in with telecommunication services.
Yes.
Back in the 1960s before the Bell split up. Is there any
Correct.
Way to make this to go back and make this work now?
Well, the question is, could you break up BAA without injuring the shareholders, you know, people who bought shares in good faith? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, clearly the government would have the power to do that. Whether it would be the right thing to do depends on if it could be a win-win proposition for shareholders as well as for airlines and their passengers. A lot of airlines are in favor of breaking up BAA, especially the low-cost carriers that are now being hit because the cross Heathrow is costing so much to expand that there isn't really cross-subsidy money available for Stansted. And so in order to expand Stansted, they're going to have to raise the prices there significantly. The low-cost carriers that serve Stansted actually believe they'd have a better shake dealing with a single company that just had Stansted to worry about, and would have lower overhead and so forth. I think those airports, each of which now is profitable and have a viable future, would do very nicely. The sum of the three value would probably be greater than today than the value of the thing as a single enterprise. So I think shareholders could be well served. There is already other airport companies like Fraport in Germany that said, well, if you put some of those airports on the market, we'd be interested in bidding.
Is there any parallel to this process that we could learn from here in the U.S.? Is there a possibility in the future that we could benefit if we were to, say, privatize the big three airports in the New York metro area?
Well, that would be the same kind of a situation, I think. So far, there's nothing like that is on the horizon, but it would be clearly a lesson to learn where you have a potentially natural competitive situation to go ahead and take advantage of that. In fact, that actually might happen in Chicago because Midway Airport is in the airport privatization pilot program. The preliminary application was filed by the city last fall. They have been in some very intense discussions with the major carrier there, Southwest, and I was told by someone close to those negotiations that we may see an announcement within the next month that they have worked out in principle a deal on how to do a privatization deal, which would be a long-term lease, that the airlines would be happy with.
Well, now, before we get into the second half of this interview, Bob, I want to just ask you for some quick comments on the recent announcement that the FAA appears to have its ducks in a row and is essentially saying to the NIMBYs, bring it on, in terms of reorganizing the airspace for the New York, Philadelphia area.
Well, I saw that announcement. I was pleased to see it, but I'm not holding my breath because I think the NIMBYs will file lawsuits and will try to tie it up as long as possible. I don't think they'll end up winning, but I think they will delay the kind of congestion relief that the airspace reorganization held some promise for, probably for several more years.
Well, and there was also a story out of Chicago where at O'Hare, the FAA has said you can go ahead and use some of the per-passenger ticket tax to make up the difference in the inflated values of real estate you're going to have to buy to expand O'Hare. That was a decision that came down in the past week or so.
I think that's also a positive step because we really need to get that O'Hare modernization project done so that O'Hare can operate more smoothly and increase its own capacity.
All right. While we're on these heretical topics here, I want to come back and talk about the idea of landing slots at the New York metro airports. We're talking with Robert Poole, who is the Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News. We'll be right back.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways, and you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Robert W. Poole, Jr., who is the Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. We're talking today about privatization issues when it comes to airports. We talked a little bit in the first half about Heathrow and Stansted and Gatwick in England. Now I want to talk a little bit about the New York airport congestion, because, Bob, you wrote about this situation in your recent airport policy newspaper. At some point, if you believe in market forces, you have to believe in setting up some sort of mechanism where market forces allocate resources if they're scarce.
And we really have a situation of scarcity in terms of available operations, landings and takeoffs per hour at the New York airports, especially at LaGuardia. But all three of them are the number one, number two, and number three most delayed airports in the United States, and it seems to be getting worse, not better. So you've got to face the fact, if you cannot expand capacity, I mean, there is some potential even at LaGuardia through next-gen technology and the airspace redesign for, you know, maybe squeezing out another 10 or 20, maybe more, percent of capacity there safely. Ultimately, nobody's going to approve building another runway out in the bay at LaGuardia, at least as far as I can tell. So that means, what do you do when the demand is 50% greater than the capacity? You've got to figure out a way to decide who gets it, or just ration by long, long delays, you know, having planes lined up waiting an hour before they can take off. And I think that's not going to prove to be acceptable over the long term.
All right. I'm looking at something that the AOPA quoted, a statistic from June 1st of this year at O'Hare Airport in Chicago. And they said that between 8 and 8:14 a.m., there were something like 57 or 59 flights that all said were scheduled to depart.
Yes.
Now, clearly, this is, you know, selling something to the consumer, i.e. a convenient departure time. And that
simply isn't possible to deliver.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
In a sense, it's kind of fraudulent. It's certainly misleading, although any experienced traveler knows, you know, that they can't really believe it. But that's not a good solution. It's really not in the airline's long-term interest. Now they will say, well, all we're doing is responding to market forces. The market forces tell us that customers would rather have frequency, than a few flights a day with the same number of seats, but in much bigger planes. And that's true, given the current price. But if we use the market to allocate the actual amount of capacity so that the price would be high during those high demand periods, and that would be reflected in ticket prices, then you'd have a different set of trade-offs probably between frequency versus average size of the plane. And it's not clear that everyone would make the same decision. There is definitely some demand for that every hour service to various points. But faced with a much higher price for that, some people would opt for, all right, I'd rather, you know, go in the 767 with 250 or 275 other people and pay a lower price, because the price for landing is spread over a lot more passengers.
All right, now tell me why you are not a fan of simply auctioning off landing slots as little slices of time, because for me, that is the mechanism that most purely passes the additional costs of demanding a peak time down to the end user.
Well, I think I'm perfectly fine, actually, with auctioning landing slots. I simply think that those auction systems can be complicated to set up. If we're looking for quick relief, and that was really my emphasis, the quickest thing we could do would be to impose a flat, basically, surcharge on the existing landing fees would probably be the easiest way to do it. Say $500 or $1,000. Added to the existing weight-based landing fee, so that that would have to get reflected in the airline's calculation about how many flights to operate at certain times, and presumably reflected in the ticket prices as well.
But doesn't it tend to average out, though, the peak times and the average times cost over all tickets, and therefore make the 3 o'clock in the morning ticket no more inexpensive than the 8 a.m. ticket?
No, I think make it dramatic. $1,000 extra charge per landing. Okay, and you're an airline. You can use four 50 seat RJs to provide a certain amount of capacity, or you could use one 767 or 757 even. And the impact on absorbing that cost. You could theoretically spread it out over all of your operations at O'Hare, the straightforward way to do it, and the one that would give them information on how much demand there really is for the higher frequency and small buckets model, would come from reflecting that directly into the ticket price.
My standpoint would be let them fly the RJs. I think that's a great idea.
It's I think there are a lot of people who would prefer that and might be willing to pay for it.
And therefore, rather than flying them, 11 minutes apart or something like that at peak times, provide an incentive by auctioning slots to have them spread out a little farther, because it seems to me that the limit on concrete space is not going to be solved by next gen.
No, it's not. It's not going to be solved. It's going to be helped, but it's definitely not going to be solved at these really high demand places like O'Hare and LaGuardia and Washington National, for that matter. But I think Paul, that when I talk with economists, and I am actually not one, but when I talk with economists who've studied this, they say you can get basically identical results with either slot auctions or market-based landing fees.
Right.
So it's just then it becomes a matter of convenience and are there side effects that you would have to guard against? Are there extra costs in using one versus the other? And I'm open to new information on that.
Actually, I wonder if auctioning landing slots wouldn't raise more money to go into the fund for increasing capacity.
It might, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's an integral part of when I advocate this. Whether it's auctions or increases or surcharges on landing fees, I think it's only fair to the passengers and to the airlines, so the users of the airports, that all the extra revenue raised from the market allocation mechanism go into a fund for expanding the capacity, with the first dibs on that money being the airport where the money is collected. And if they can't come up with anything productive to do with it, then the next preference would go to any other airport in the metro area that can offer capacity additions that would help relieve the overall congestion in that metro area.
All right, Bob, you've been watching this for a lot of years now. What odds would you put on some version of this coming to pass?
That's a tough question. 10 years ago, I would have said, about 1%. I'd say, maybe 30% odds today, which is still not at all, far from a guarantee. But there's been a lot more research, a lot more talk. The FAA has actually paid for some good studies by people that I respect on how to do these kind of market mechanisms at the really congested airports. So I think there's hope, and especially as people really crunch the numbers on what next gen will and won't do and see that it's definitely not going to resolve the congestion problem at these really high demand places. The only thing we have left, other than arbitrary restrictions, which I don't think anybody would like to see, is really to use one of the market mechanisms.
Or to do what the Japanese have done, and we'll build a big floating runway out in the bay.
Well, I'm not averse to that, but I just think the NIMBYs would just tie that up for decades.
All right. Well, Bob, listen, we always appreciate a chance to talk to you. I know your views are sometimes controversial, but I don't think anybody disputes the fact that we need to look at some kind of options for what's happening to the airspace around New York City. And we appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you, Paul.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.